Hey there! If you like true crime stories and you love being in the great outdoors, you have come to the right place. I'm Tara, your host. Welcome to Crime Off the Grid. Welcome, everyone, to the Crime Off the Grid podcast. I'm Tara, your host, and thanks so much for joining us. Hey, I want to say thanks to all of you who are regular listeners, and I appreciate you and all of your comments and suggestions, so keep them coming. And back by popular demand today, Ranger Nancy is here with us again. Hi, Nancy.
Good morning, Tara.
That's right. We were just talking about how it's a little early in the morning for us normally. because retired folks don't roll out of bed so early, but there's stuff to be done today. So we wanted to get this recorded today. Well, before we get started, I want to say that the case that we're discussing has not yet been adjudicated or closed. The suspect in this case has not had her day in court yet, and I want to emphasize that she is presumed innocent until proven guilty in a court of law. All of the facts of the story that we're talking about is public information from the sworn affidavit, a transcript from a court hearing, and other court documents that we were pulling all the information from. And then the media publications that we're also using as sources reference the same court documents as well. I have all the sources we used listed in the show notes where you can check them if you scroll down from the start of the podcast. And that's where you can find sources for all of our episodes. And we'll definitely provide any updates on this case as to other hearings and trial info, because this is actually pretty interesting. Our story takes place in a national park in the great state of Ohio. We're going to go to Cuyahoga Valley National Park. The park's administered by the National Park Service, but within its boundaries are areas independently managed as county parks or as other public or private businesses. And the park's about 22 miles long, going north to south, and 5 miles wide at its greatest point. It follows the Cuyahoga River, which I looked up, and the word Cuyahoga is believed to mean crooked river and came from a Native American word. There are many waterfalls along the river, and the most popular being Brandywine Falls. It's the largest in the park, which is 60 feet tall. Cuyahoga Valley was originally designated as a national recreation area in 1974, then redesignated as a national park later in 2000. And remains, fun fact, Nancy, the only national park that originated as a national recreation area. So I didn't know that I thought there would be more of that. Because,
reading about this park, it sounds like an amazing place.
It does. It sounds like a little piece of wild wilderness in a big city urban area.
Yeah, it definitely does.
What's the only national park in the state of Ohio and one of three in the Great Lakes Basin, with Isle Royale National Park in Lake Superior and Indiana Dunes National Park bordering Lake Michigan. Mm-hmm. That's another one. Oh, yeah. That's one of three. Okay, yeah. So there's a spot referred to in the park as Terra Vista Natural Study Area and is home to more than 20 types of butterflies. This national park research site is one of over 1,000 places across the U.S. where scientists track butterfly populations. That sounds like some place. You know, where's that place in South America where you can go and just see millions of butterflies hatching in the air? Have you seen that?
I've seen pictures of it. I don't know where it's at, but yes, I have seen pictures of it.
That's how kind of, maybe it's not like that. That's where all the monarch butterflies are, I think. But it sounds like a wonderful place to just go, and there must be a lot of butterflies there or else they wouldn't have a natural study area dedicated to studying butterflies. But anyway, well, Terra Vista, to get to there, you park at the trailhead on a place called Tinker's Road, and you hike up this gravel service road to the entrance sign, and then there's a fishing pond, a historic cemetery, and then it makes a loop trail. And there's a reason I mentioned that specific location. Anyway, Cuyahoga Valley. What can I say, Valley? Cuyahoga Valley also differs from other national parks in America in that it's adjacent to two large urban areas, Cleveland and Akron. How do you say it? Cleveland and Akron. Good night. And it includes a dense road network, and it's interspersed with small towns. There's four little reservations of Cleveland Metro Parks, 11 parks of the Summit Metro Parks, and other public and private attractions like two ski areas, which I didn't know they had enough snow in Ohio for skiing. That's how dumb I am, I guess. I got to get out more. And then, it's in the north. Why wouldn't it have a ski area? An outdoor music amphitheater.
So, and you know what? It's free. It's free to get into this national park.
That's right. It's free. So if I lived there, I'd definitely be taking advantage of that place probably every day if I could. So it's kind of like a checkerboard of jurisdiction. And I was talking to a ranger that used to work in Cuyahoga, and it's mostly a day use park similar to other city parks, meaning there aren't campgrounds or overnight accommodations. But interestingly, there are 17 different law enforcement agencies throughout the park system. But the case today, did occur in federal jurisdiction, which is why we're talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's get started.
Okay, let's get started.
Around 11 a.m. on March 9th, 2021, officers with the Valley View Police Department in Ohio responded to the Terra Vista Cemetery regarding the discovery of a deceased male by a group of hikers. The body was found in a wooded area adjacent to the cemetery. And I saw an aerial view of the cemetery area. So it's this really long, when you get to like off of that Tinker's Road and walk into the cemetery, it's a long, it looks like it's a mowed with a lawnmower, mowed grassy path. And then this like round area at the end of the grassy path of the cemetery. And then that seems to be lined with trees. So really right on the edge of the cemetery is where a body was found.
It sounds like it. They said deep into the woods.
And when I was talking to this ranger, he kind of said, it's not that far. But I mean, I think probably in a very urban area, it was considered deep into the woods.
Mm-hmm.
And the cemetery there is actually a historic site with some of the graves dating back to 1810. And I read that the most recent grave is from 1919. So pretty old historic cemetery.
Yeah, it is.
Officers found an ID card in the deceased man's pocket and identified him as Matthew Dunmire. And I don't like to say the names of crime victims, mainly ones who are still alive, but I'll mention it if they are deceased and it's something that's well publicized, which this is, and his name is already out there and it's also in all of the court documents as well. And so normally I don't like to, but I also feel odd referring to him with just initials, like sometimes we do with victims. So anyway, we'll refer to him by his name. So back up a few days, March 5th, 2021, 4 days before Matthew was found, he was out at a local bar called the Tiki Underground with a group of people he worked with from, I guess he worked at a screen printing shop. Matthew told his supervisor when they were there at the bar that he was planning to meet a woman from out of town who was staying over in the Cleveland area. And the exact relationship between the two, Matthew and this woman he was going to meet, or how they know each other was not clear to the coworkers. And then a publication that I was looking at described Matthew as a father of two and an avid guitarist from Virginia. So at around 6 p.m. that night, Matthew got a text, quote, "She's here." He sort of announced to all of his coworkers and then just walked out of the Tiki Underground bar, and his supervisor was following him, going outside with him. The supervisor told the police that he watched Matthew get into a white smart car with Virginia plates, and a dark-haired woman was behind the wheel. There was a Coast Guard sticker on the rear window along with other distinctive bumper stickers and a third sticker reading, quote, "Virginia's for lovers." It's a pretty popular bumper sticker in Virginia. I guess that's their logo, or what do you call that? Nickname. No, what's the nickname of every state has a nickname. Virginia's for lovers is a,
I think that is, yeah, I think you're right. That I think that is their saying.
Yeah.
Nickname.
Yeah.
I found it interesting that he followed him outside it's almost like he wanted to meet her, but that's just, I've never, it just seems weird that he would follow him outside to see
I thought so too. Maybe he was a very protective supervisor. Maybe he, he just, maybe he had a weird feeling or, we are going to learn that Matthew did have a girlfriend. So maybe it had something to do with that. I don't know.
Yeah, that could be.
And so they also described the vehicle that he got into was a white smart car. Do you know what a smart car is?
Electric? I don't know.
Well, I think it's also electric, but in my mind, I mean, I've always seen this car. I've seen, you see this car in towns or whatever, not so much in Idaho, but, I'm like, that looks like a clown car. You know what a clown car looks like? You know, like at the circus where all these clowns, like this little bitty bitty car and all these clowns keep popping out of it. And so I looked up clown, I looked up smart car. And yep, that's what I thought. There are these cute little cars that look like they'd be death traps. Although apparently they say there's good safety ratings. Anyway, I was really getting off on a tangent there, but I cannot look at one of those and not call it a clown car.
Yes, I agree. That's the first thing I think of too.
Well, it doesn't take long for law enforcement to come up with a suspect, actually. According to a transcript of a court document, Special Agent Greg Craig of the FBI lays out the evidence of the government in a hearing before the U.S. magistrate under oath. And again, this transcript is where I'm getting most of the events of our story. So he explained that his office had become involved on Wednesday, March 10th, the day after the body was found. An autopsy was done that day and a bullet was found in his head. At that point, realizing there was a crime that had taken place, the Valley View Police Department called into the Bureau of Criminal Investigations, which is a state crime organization, and the FBI and the National Park Service were notified as well since it was on federal land. Remember, there's 17 separate law enforcement agencies in the park there. And so I think they have concurrent jurisdiction, meaning at least as far as federally, another agency there can respond to and has police authority on federal land. But the FBI did become the lead investigative agency along with the National Park Service for this particular incident.
Correct.
And by the way, this will come up later, but there was no firearm found on scene anywhere near the body, and his cell phone was never recovered. So put a pin in that.
Okay.
Agent Craig said that prior to the FBI's involvement, the Bureau of Criminal Investigations, BCI, and the Valley View Police Department had already conducted some interviews with a current roommate of Matthew and a former girlfriend that they found. And they both told how Matthew had gone to the local bar on Friday evening with coworkers, and Matthew had been texting with them on Friday into Saturday, and his texts just stopped on Saturday. So on the morning of March 6th, which is Saturday, Matthew texted his actual girlfriend, who was identified as AW, that he had just woken up, was going to go donate plasma, and he would come back to their apartment. And Matthew asked her not to be upset and said he did not, quote, sleep with her, end quote. And at approximately 8:39 a.m., he texted her again saying he was, quote, guessing that she did not miss him and was mad at him last night. And Matthew said further, quote, well, I pissed this chick off anyway, so I hope you're happy, end quote. They never received any more texts. Law enforcement also interviewed the coworkers from the bar and the supervisor. And again, they told about the plans with the female and that they saw Matthew get into that clown car. On March 11th, the BCI executed a search warrant on Matthew's Google account. And from that, one of the things that was discovered was his geolocation data, GPS information showing where he had traveled. And they tracked his phone from the bar on Friday night going up to Cleveland, and they know that he spent the night there and even tracked it to an Airbnb. And then on Saturday, they could see that he returned back down to the park and went into the Terra Vista Natural Study area. So they took that route on paper or whatever, digitally, and his GPS locations. And then they matched that with the various intersections that the cell phone went through and that they were able to get video images of the vehicle and read the license plate.
That's awesome. Technology.
Technology. I mean, you can't go anywhere. There's cameras, people. That should be like, you know, our motto and watch out for the company you keep. And oh yeah, there's cameras. So they went back and looked between March 5th and March 7th and saw that vehicle, the clown car, was spotted on the Ohio Turnpike 6 times. So the license plate comes back registered to a John Perkins, and his spouse's name is Chelsea Perkins. And Chelsea Perkins was the name registered to the Airbnb that they tracked Matthew's phone to.
Yeah, she used her own credit card to stay at this Airbnb to make
right.
a reservation.
Yeah, yeah. And also by, also by tracking his phone, they saw video footage of Matthew and the female at a restaurant and other places of business, and the female matched the description of Chelsea Perkins. So they put two and two together. They got warrants for Chelsea's phone, and then they matched the locations from her phone to the same as Matthew.
Mm-hmm.
So that's some pretty good and actually quick investigative work, I think, that they were doing there.
Yeah, yeah, they really, it really was.
After the information about a body being found in the park was made public in the news and everything, on March 15th, the FBI received a call from a witness who wanted to report some information, and she and her significant other were in the park on the 6th at the Terra Vista Trailhead about 10:30 in the morning that day and saw this small white vehicle, and they noticed the stickers on the rear of the vehicle, and one of the stickers was a Coast Guard sticker that stuck out to them, and of course, it's not hard to notice a clown car on the, in the Trailhead parking area, so they go on their hike, and around 11:30, between 11:30 and 12, she said, they hear a single gunshot. So they decide to go back to their vehicle, and then they notice that the clown car was still there. So I don't know. They weren't out hiking very long. They hear a gunshot, and they're like, yeah, we're not going to continue. And I wouldn't either, because it's not like you're in the Forest Service where they're potentially hunters, and it's a single gunshot.
Correct.
Special Agent Craig also stated that they had another couple as witnesses who encountered a female on March 6th while walking their dog in the park. And they lived in the neighborhood adjacent to that area. And when they encountered this female at approximately 1 o'clock that day, they weren't very far actually from where the body was found. And they mentioned that she wasn't really wearing attire typical for someone hiking in the woods. They described mm-hmm. her as being female with dark hair, wearing a hoodie, black stretch pants or tights. And so far, I'm thinking, that sounds hikey to me. But then they said,
yeah, it does.
I don't know what's unusual about that. Not everybody wants to dress like Land's End, I guess. But then they said she was wearing black knee-high boots. And I don't know if you know my thing about appropriate footwear. Nancy, have you heard me talk about appropriate footwear?
I don't believe I have.
well, you know, in the parks, in the park, in a national park, I can tell you every single broken ankle call that I have been on, or possible sprained ankle or foot injury that I've ever been on, was wearing inappropriate footwear.
I agree with that completely.
Yes. Yes. Sandals, whatever Tevas, and they go hiking way down this trail and they're wearing those, you know what? Yeah.
Flip flop.
Yeah. So this is, you know, but people go get their pedicures and by golly, they're going to show their toenails at their own peril. This one's a little different though. It's black knee-high boots and I don't know if they had heels to them or not. So I'm not going to call this inappropriate mm-hmm. footwear necessarily. But they said she seemed disoriented and that she was looking to get back to the cemetery that was nearby. And the couple, of course, knew right where that was. So they invited her to walk with them for part of the way back towards the cemetery. And then after a ways, mm-hmm. they parted paths. Well, there were some other pieces of evidence that Agent Craig mentioned in the hearing that was found at the scene that were sent to the crime lab. And they found a water bottle, which actually was an Aquafina water bottle. And then they also sent the items he was wearing as well, a black coat with gloves that had the fingers cut out. And then there was also a blue medical mask because in March 2021, COVID hasn't quite gone away for the most part.
Correct. Yeah. Yep.
But I think it's interesting that they seem to be dressed very similarly. Did you catch that? Yeah, she's wearing all black. Yeah, and he's wearing all black with those gloves with the fingers out. So,
Yeah, I saw that.
So they analyzed Matthew's body and other evidence collected near where the body was found. And testing identified the presence of each of Perkins and Matthew's DNA on the mouth and the exterior cap of the Aquafina water bottle found next to his body. Mm-hmm. Perkins' DNA was the major contributor on, this is interesting, Matthew's pubic hair, and her DNA was also present in his fingernails. And the autopsy report following the medical examiner's office examination of Matthew's body and the other collected evidence revealed that Matthew died as a result of a gunshot wound to the back of the head.
Interesting.
The autopsy report stated that the manner of death was homicide. And the report concluded that the bullet recovered from Matthew's head was a 9mm caliber round of ammunition. So law enforcement was able to track Chelsea Perkins' travels from March 6th, the day of the murder. She left Cleveland and directly went to get a tattoo from a place in Detroit. The tattoo that she got was on her forearm of a hangman's noose and writing that said, quote, "Tighten up."
Yep, I saw that too.
Now they know the whereabouts of Chelsea Perkins. So on March 17th, which, you know, just a week after finding the body, agents with the National Park Service, according to the affidavit, conducted surveillance at the home of Chelsea and John Perkins in Arlington, Virginia. They located the white smart car parked in front of their apartment complex and noticed that two of the distinctive bumper stickers had been removed, including the Virginia is for Lovers sticker.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So, as if the clown car wasn't distinctive enough, she probably was like, well, I better get rid of all these bumper stickers that say Coast Guard. And on March 30th, 2021, investigators executed a search warrant of the Perkins home there in Arlington. They recovered 3 9mm pistols. One was a Glock and 2 Springfield Armory pistols, which I'm not familiar with those. And one armory pistol was found inside a woman's purse or bag, which also contained an identification card for Chelsea Perkins. So It looks like that would belong to her. And each of these firearms was test fired by Bureau of Criminal Investigations at the state and checked for DNA. It was determined that Chelsea Perkins' DNA was the major source of DNA on the 9mm Springfield armory pistol that was recovered from the purse. And the ballistics report that compared the markings on the bullet recovered from Matthew's head with the test-fired bullets from the recovered Glock pistol and the 2 Springfield armory pistols, the report determined that the markings on the bullet recovered from Matthew's head had similar characteristics as the markings from rounds fired from the Springfield armory pistols, but not the same characteristics as the markings from rounds fired from the Glock pistol. So they ruled out the Glock right
away. Yeah, because they're all unique.
Right. Now, all of this testing for DNA and ballistics testing actually takes a while. So while they got after it and identified the suspect and everything very quickly and served the search warrant and all that, you know, it still takes a while. It's not like on Law and Order where everything happens within an hour time slot. And federally, for felony cases, you need an indictment for a grand jury before you make an arrest, typically, unless you catch somebody in the act of committing the felony. Also, during that time, I don't know if this is the case for this incident, but it's just coming out of that whole COVID period. And I do know that there were many cases, and a lot that I was involved in as well, where the grand juries were backed up and court cases got delayed all because of COVID, and things just seemed to take a extra long time during that period. And I don't know if that's what was going on here or not.
So you're right, Tara. Everything did get backed up during the COVID for many different reasons. And I'm sure court was one of them, or getting somebody indicted. So this story takes a really weird twist to it. So Tommy Lynn Dunmire, which was Matthew's mother, and her partner, longtime partner, John Nelson McQuillan, they lived in the Virginia area, and they were getting frustrated because it was taking so long for police to find out who actually killed their son. So Tommy Lynn and her partner, John, she was getting super frustrated with it. So she started her own investigation to find out who actually killed her son. She wasn't waiting for the police. She was frustrated with them. Wow. And so it's like, I'm going to do my own thing.
Wow.
So she starts doing the research for this. And she believes that she found the person that killed her son.
Huh.
So Dunmire and McQuillan drove from Norfolk to Washington, D.C. Now, I looked that up. It's 3 hours and 20 minutes to drive there. It's about 200 miles.
Oh, that's yes. far. Okay.
And they went to a woman's house in Kingman Park. They went to her home. And they say that prosecutors said that Dunmire put on a brown vest and a brown baseball cap and carried a cardboard box to the woman's front door. And so knocking and announcing herself as a UPS delivery driver.
Oh, wow.
I know. When the woman opened the door, Dunmire fired 2 shots from a silver revolver that she was holding inside the opening that she cut in the back of the box.
What?
So the front of the box had no, it was just the box, and she had cut a hole in the back, stuck the pistol in there, and was holding it like it was a package. So after she shoots this person twice, Dunmire and McQuillan, they take off in their Honda Pilot SUV. And when they got a short distance away from where they committed this crime, they stopped and McQuillan changed the license plates on the vehicle in an attempt to evade police.
That's some serious planning.
It is. When DC police stopped the vehicle soon after, and the residents, from what I read, was in the 1400 block or the 1600 block, and this car was stopped, SUV was stopped in the 1400 block of Florida Avenue Northeast. When the police stopped and they got out of the car and the officers approaching the vehicle, Dunmire shot herself.
Oh my gosh.
I know. She didn't die right then and there, so they call an ambulance and they take her to a hospital where she ends up dying 2 weeks later.
Oh.
From her injuries, from her self-inflicted injuries.
I wonder if she ever gained consciousness or anything. It probably didn't say.
It didn't, yeah. The article didn't say that I had read. So the woman that she shot had nothing to do with Matthew's death. So it was a bizarre series of events, an apparent case of mistaken identity. So she does her own research and comes up with the wrong person and goes to this house thinking that this is the woman that killed my son.
Right.
And shoots her and ends up being the wrong person. Now, the woman that got shot, she actually lived. She
had
the injuries. Yes, the injuries were not fatal. So she recovered from the gunshots that happened to her. So then the father of Matthew, John, he's still in the car. So he's witnessing everything, you know, that happened with Tommy shooting himself and everything like that. But he told the police that he had to drive her.
What?
And the police, you know, but he says, he first told the police that he did not know what Dunmire was planning.
Oh, there's no way.
I know. So he
believed I just happened to have this extra set of license plates. Why don't we put them on since you just shot somebody?
Yeah. And I didn't know that you were going to do that. And I believed that you were just going to go and talk to her. So you always need an extra set of license plates when you're going to go see.
Right.
Just talk to somebody about the incidents. Yeah. But he said she didn't know what she was going to do, but he had to drive her there. So he was arrested in Virginia, and he still, to this day, remains in jail until his sentencing. So he was charged with not not murder, not accessory, but he was charged with an accessory after the fact for failure to call the police right after the shooting took place and tell the police, turn her in, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
And he didn't do that. So that's what he was charged with. He doesn't have a history of anything that, you know, no charges. No, he just doesn't have a criminal history at all. So he was not charged with shooting or conspiring to shoot, but he was charged with after the fact.
Wow. That's another, that sounds like a revenge, definitely revenge gone wrong. Not that revenge can go right.
Right, exactly. And it was. It was a revenge gone wrong. And they wanted justice, and they thought that this was the way to get justice.
Well,
but turns out that that's not the way to do it.
You know what's interesting? I didn't read in depth the information that you just told, so I just sort of glossed over it. But what I was thinking when I heard about that was the parents of a deceased victim of homicide are considered legal victims of a crime as well. So, you know, it's in the Attorney General Guidelines for Victim Witness Assistance, and that policy dictates that the parents would now be legal victims, which would be entitled to all rights and services, as well as Matthew's two children. He had two young children. So I have to assume that since the FBI was the lead investigative agency, their victim services division would have provided them with victim assistance. And at the time when I was working and I was responsible for the victim assistance program in the Park Service, I was in contact with the lead National Park Service special agent in charge. He told me, you know, I was just trying to verify, is there in fact victim assistance being provided to family members? And I knew nothing of the details of the case. And he said, yes, there was. So I'm assuming here that it was the FBI Victim Services Division because it was a federal case. And
right.
That would include providing them with notice and case updates. That's required by law, which would be like, you know, keeping them updated and apprised on what's happening with the case without revealing evidence. I mean, nobody's going to tell them, here's the evidence we have. But, you know, just helping them with the whole criminal justice process. And so that would, you know, I've done this a lot too. Like, I know this case has taken a long time, but I'm assuring you that they are still working on this. They've got this many people, you know, they're doing testing right now. It just takes a while from the lab or something. So you're constantly keeping the victims apprised of what's going on in that way. And so that victim specialist sort of becomes like a liaison of sorts between the victims and the agency as well, letting them know things, you know, yes, still moving along. So it takes time. And I'm just going to throw this out there as an aside. I usually link to parents in a situation like this with the National Organization of Parents of Murdered Children. So if anybody wants to look that up, it's or knows anybody that could use this resource, they would provide ongoing emotional support, education, advocacy, and just link them with others who've gone through the same thing. So they're a very, very good organization. And I know the FBI Victim Services would have done that for them. But, you know, that doesn't mean a victim takes advantage of that, you know, willingly receives these resources because, you know, they're going through trauma as well. So I don't really know what's going on with her and if she had any other mental instabilities at the time. And I'm not excusing anything. I'm not at all. So, but it's just ironic that they would technically be legal victims. And this is what happened.
And I agree. And I think that based off of McQuillan's testimony or interview, that he did say that Dunmire's mental status began to deteriorate. And she expressed rage and the desire to confront and to kill the person that is responsible for the murder of her son, Matthew. So I agree with you, and I'm not sure what they were informed about or how often that they were brought up to speed on the case. Because like you said earlier, I think COVID had a lot to do with everything kind of at a snail's pace as far as, you know, getting information out. So I think with her mental status deteriorating, not only from COVID, but also from this traumatic event, that it caused her to take her own action.
What did you say was the date of that?
the date of
her killing or shooting mistaken identity revenge.
I don't know if I set a date. He went to court last November for it.
Oh, okay.
So I'm not sure what the date was on that.
Because I when we were talking earlier, I thought you had said something like
In March of 2021 is when McQuillan told police that they were frustrated and growing impatient with the investigation into their son's death. That Dumeier began conducting her own investigation
in March.
March of 2021
was right when he was. That's the month he was killed.
Yeah, correct.
Okay, finally. All this evidence was presented to a grand jury, and the jury returned a 3-count indictment charging Chelsea Perkins, who was 31 at the time, with first-degree murder, second-degree murder, and discharging a firearm during and in relation to a crime of violence. And she was arrested on December 9th, 2021. And I gotta say, I think that's pretty fast.
For everything that we just talked about, I agree
yeah.
with that was really fast. And then, when she was arrested, a month prior to that is when Matthew's mother shot herself. So when Chelsea was arrested and charged, a month prior to that, so in November, is when Matthew's mother shot and killed herself.
Wow. Wow, if she
could
only just hung on.
They were getting there if she'd have just hung on.
Right, right. Also, the investigation did uncover how Matthew and Chelsea actually knew each other, because the friends and coworkers didn't really know what that connection was. Investigators mm-hmm. knew that Matthew was from Virginia, and they had information that they knew each other as early as 2017. Chelsea had filed a rape allegation against Matthew on March 22nd of 2017. And she said that the rape had occurred on March 16th, just a week earlier. And so she reported that to the Coast Guard, but that went to the Virginia police, and the investigators with Virginia police there during their investigation. So they did an investigation, and I don't know how extensive, but they did not feel that they had enough to go forward with a prosecution. So Matthew was never charged for the alleged rape of Chelsea. Now, let me just say, that doesn't mean there was no sexual assault, that there was no rape. Mm-hmm. That's not what that means at all when somebody doesn't go forward with a prosecution. Those cases are very hard to prosecute for a lot of reasons. And prosecutors really like having their odds be better than not of getting a conviction. So a lot of times they won't take these cases. 70% of sexual assaults are non-stranger assaults. We used to call those date rapes, but that doesn't mean people were on a date necessarily, but non-stranger. So somebody known to them, and very few are ever reported. And of those that are reported, very few get prosecuted. And false reports are very rare. And I'm not saying this was or was not a false report. I'm just saying false reports are very rare. End Violence Against Women International, which is an organization founded by a detective from San Diego, a phenomenal organization. I've been to a couple of their conferences. They teach a lot of people on investigations of sexual assault and domestic violence. So I got a source from them where they cite rigorous research that's been conducted on false reporting. And this research estimates the percentage of false reports start to converge around 2-8%. And also, if Chelsea was in fact assaulted by Matthew when she reported it, she should have been provided with rape crisis intervention and access to other services, including counseling. And I have no idea if she was provided anything, if she accepted it or received any services. And that's regardless of whether a case goes forward. So anytime you report something, you know, no matter what, you're entitled under the Victims' Rights and Restitution Act, you're entitled to receive services. But I do know that there is a lot of trauma that occurs with being sexually assaulted and not being believed, especially. But let me be clear here. I'm not blaming the deceased victim for his murder. And nor am I excusing any actions by the reported rape victim for the homicide that she is accused of. So if that makes sense, I'm just throwing some stuff out.
A lot of times it's a he said, she said thing that they run into. And so I'm sure that the prosecutors want, like you said, kind of wrapped up in a bow so that they can get a conviction.
Right. Well, I said this on a previous podcast. There are two defenses for a rape or sexual assault accusation. One is you got the wrong guy. I didn't do it. That's not me. You know, you must be mistaken. It's not me. I wasn't even there. The second defense is the consent defense, which is, I did that, but it was totally consensual. She wanted that. He wanted that. And it was totally consensual. So that is why it's incredibly hard to prosecute those cases. Mm-hmm. If you don't have any other, and there are definitely a lot of ways to do it. And we get those convictions all the time. But just in this case, for whatever reason, they didn't feel like they could go forward with it. So they got warrants for the social media accounts, and they found accounts that belonged to Chelsea with different usernames. One being, quote, I'm dead, I'm dead, I'm dead, end quote. And that was a username. And another name was Selena Savage. Anyway, she was communicating with another username, Metal Gary Solid, which I don't know where these people come up with their usernames. Metal, M-E-T-A-L, Gary Solid. Anyway, and they were communicating about someone named Matt. And they were talking about seeing Matt as a friend's suggestion. And Chelsea says, I bet he got dumped. And the Metal Gary guy says, quote, that guy's a walking turd. And then she writes L-M-F-A-O and says, I don't know how people still F with him. And Metal Guy says, quote, me neither. Like, how the F does he live with himself? Then Chelsea says, he is really that effed up, and says, quote, he will get his someday, dot, dot, dot. And Mr. Metal Guy says, karma is an evil bitch. And then this communication was all in February, just a month prior to Matthew's murder. And by the way, immediately after Chelsea left Cleveland and she's headed to get her tattoo, she deletes everything, like deletes her social media accounts, deletes all her text messages, or so she thinks. And she deactivates her Facebook and Instagram accounts.
Yeah. So she got rid of everything completely. So she thought.
Right. So, well, the FBI agents say they subsequently unearthed a draft of a suicide note on Chelsea's phone, which she attempted unsuccessfully to delete. And it suggested that she planned to cover up the crime by making it appear that Matthew had killed himself. That note was created on March 9th and deleted right away. And it says, quote, if you are reading this, it is too late. I'm sorry I beat you and I raped a couple of chicks years ago. I am a shitty person and paid for my sins with blood. I've decided to leave this cruel world. Sorry I didn't warn you first, end quote. And that,
wow.
Yeah, that really sounds like there were some feelings of serious rage and desire for revenge. So she is thinking about this assault from 2017 as she's writing this suicide note.
Sure she is.
So Matthew's former coworker said that his kids were back in Virginia and that he had moved to Ohio to better his life. He always seemed so happy, he said, and it just made my day. I'm pretty picky about the people who I become friends with, and he was one of the people I felt like I could really connect with. He goes on to say, the night that it happened, my coworkers and he were at the Tiki Underground Lounge, and I'm kicking myself because I ended up not going. I wish I was there, and it would have been the last time I could have spent time with him. You can't predict these things. It's just very sad and unfortunate, but I'm so glad this person who did this was caught. He says, I think about a week prior to all of this, Matthew was so excited because he was trying to stop drinking. He was really proud of himself. He was turning his life around. And I remember he made a comment about having his whole life ahead of him. And then this happened, end quote. So it does sound like he had people who loved him. He had good friends and they were supportive of his new attempt at bettering his life. Well, Chelsea is currently awaiting trial, which has not been set yet. The date has not at the time of this recording. And as I said, stay tuned. We'll provide updates. And it looks like there's a pretrial conference set for February 6th. And possible trial dates might be set for May of 2024. That's this year, according to the last hearing held on December 6th, just last month, 2023.
And she's being held. She did not get out on bond.
That's right. She had a detention hearing and they held her.
Yep.
You know, when I've mentioned to people, you know, somebody asked what I do for the National Park Service in the last few years, you know, when I was working with just victims of crime, and people always seem so surprised that there are victims in the national parks. But really, most often, people come with their offenders. People travel with the person who is going to do them harm.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like there's a lot of boogeymen hanging out in national parks and national forests.
Yeah.
There are some. And we've talked about some serial killers on this show. But most often, just like in sexual assaults, they're non-strangers. And most often, people bring their offenders with them.
Yeah, when I was working in the National Park Service or even the Forest Service, people were surprised that I carried a gun. And they're like, what do you need that for?
Bears?
You know, and yeah, exactly. And, you know, so you try and educate people, you know, in a way that you can without standing there for a long time talking to them, but just to try and educate them on why we do carry weapons in the national parks or national forests.
Well, speaking of high crimes going on in the national parks, did you hear that or see that article about James Bond, what he did?
I saw the article, but I did not read it. I just saw the headlines.
It's been all over the news. I don't know why this is big national news. It's been on CNN, USA Today, Fox News, and all kinds of local news outlets. Former James Bond actor Pierce Brosnan charged with trespassing at Yellowstone National Park.
And wow.
As I know, Pierce Brosnan, the former James Bond actor, has reportedly been charged with going off the prescribed trail near the Mammoth Hot Springs area in Yellowstone National Park. That's your old stomping grounds.
That is my stomping grounds, yeah.
As a result, Brosnan is due to appear at a Wyoming court, which is the front of the magistrate in Mammoth, on January 23rd. Hey, that's
a couple weeks away.
Hey, that's coming soon. Ooh, we'll have to stay updated on that. Well, the article goes on to say, this may sound like a trivial situation, wandering off the path in a national park, but it is an offense that the U.S. National Park Service takes very seriously. This is because the area in question, the Mammoth Hot Springs, is extremely dangerous. There are over 10,000 different hydrothermal features that are active across the park, ranging from hot springs and mud pots to fumaroles and geysers. The latter are so numerous that the park reports over half the world's active geysers are located at Yellowstone. Those are fun facts. And all of these hydrothermal features are visible expression of the immense Yellowstone volcano that heats the groundwater and forces it to the surface. Blah, 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 blah. So,
you know, when I worked in Mammoth, the terraces have a boardwalk, and it's a really nice boardwalk, and it's a lot of it, so you can walk all over the area. But once you go off the boardwalk, it is known that the crust on those terraces in some places can be very thin.
Yeah.
And as you walk across it, you can actually fall through.
Right.
So looking at it, it just looks like steam vents and some water flow is coming out of those, you know, out of the terraces, but in actuality, you don't know that your next step isn't going to have you fall through.
Right, right. And I don't know if you've even been on one of those calls. I've been on a full thickness thermal burn where a kid stepped in, slid in, whatever they did at the time, were completely submerged up above their ankle, their foot, and looks completely full thick. That's like they're boiled. Their foot was just literally boiled. And then there, we've had several instances of people dying from falling into thermals. Back in the 90s, those three employees that thought they were jumping over the creek and landed into a hot springs. And a couple of them died and the other was seriously injured. And this happens every single year. And so that's why it's a big deal, if people were wondering. And then the magistrate in Yellowstone, all people who, quote, trespass into the thermals have to go to court. and be seen by the magistrate. And he'll just get a fine. But anyway, I thought that was kind of interesting. And I had just, when I heard the story, I had just watched Mamma Mia for the second time. It had been years. And I'll tell you, all I could think of when I read this was like, why did they put Pierce Brosnan in Mamma Mia? He can't sing. Every single one of those people in Mamma Mia sang beautifully. It was a musical. And then they put Pierce Brosnan in there and gave him lots of solo singing. I'm just saying. So now really,
I've seen the movie several times.
Yes. He can't sing. He's the only one who can't sing. Bless his heart.
Oh, that's fun.
Well, hey, thanks again, Nancy, for coming on to Crime Off the Grid. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. Stay safe in wild places and watch out for the company you keep.
And also remember, I used to tell my employees at Mount Rushmore all the time that the lights are on and the cameras are rolling.